Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting, so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MC Esterbrook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Esterbrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
Dr. No is producing today from his sick bed, practically. The walking wounded in the back room there, and we appreciate that. But
thanks for coming in. I'm
fast recovery for the whole No family.
Feeling out of sorts myself a little this morning. I guess I'll have to leave quickly so we don't trade viri.
Well, that'd probably be a good idea.
There's a lot going around. A lot of debilitating stuff going around.
There certainly is. Paul, what do you think of the fact that there is going to be a pro-war rally in Washington, D.C. tomorrow, as this anti-war rally, apparently not very well organized anti-war rally,
which war are they pro? Are they pro-attacking Iran or just anyone in general? Or
Darfur. We got to get the bad guys
come
in Darfur.
Come on. That's a bunch of crap.
I beg your pardon?
You want to have an argument at the beginning of the show about Darfur?
Well, of course, because the warmongering around Darfur is just amazing. It's astonishing. We've got that.
The war in Darfur is astonishing too. I'm not.
We've got our posure of a
humanitarian military intervention.
We've got a posure of a junior senator standing up there, you know, making capital out of this, calling for sending troops to Africa. I mean, this is outrageous.
They're not willing to pay to send food there, but they're willing to send troops in.
You're precisely right.
I urge that they do give money to a disinterested African party, which they're. You know, I don't want NATO in there. What do you? Do you want a Danish soldier in? There are Danish soldiers in Afghanistan. That makes it quite uncomfortable, I'm sure. They should be probably from the Muslim world, maybe from Malaysia or something like that. I'm all for some kind of intervention at this point because it's gotten incredibly extreme. But I'm not. I don't think that you can call people who are concerned about the ongoing killing in Darfur a pro-war rally.
Well, that's exactly what's going
it's
on in Washington.
It's not exactly what's
it's
going
a pro-war,
on.
It's a pro-war rally. They're
it's
calling
a
pro for
doing
military...
something, and I think we should argue
they're calling for
what we want to be done
They're calling for a military force to be sent to the Sudan. And who's behind the rally? I mean, this is very interesting indeed. A ragtag collection of evangelicals and establishment Jews, those whom the corporate media designate as official leaders of the
who's
Jewish
community.
Who's
that characterization by the way?
I'm quoting Yoshi Furuhashi, whose blog, Montages, is one of the few places I've seen that's written about this. Keeping the peace within the diverse Save Darfur coalition has not been easy. Tensions have arisen, in particular, between evangelical Christians and immigrants from Darfur. Yeah, I'm surprised you're in bed with the evangelical Christians here, Paul.
I'm in bed with nobody lately, but let's not go into that.
I'm sorry about that. Probably just as well, you're not well. In any case, the disingenuousness of this rally in Washington is really quite terrible. I mean,
the
whole notion that the official enemy, I mean, that we've got an Arab state here that can be official enemies works very nicely with the administration's position. And no place was this more clearly set out than when William Kristol was on the Colbert Report the other night. And Colbert, who is a very clever guy, gets Kristol to say, well, top of the list is Darfur. You know, Colbert says, weren't you a member of the original neocon group, the Project for a New American Century? Oh, yes, says Kristol. Well, what should we be doing now? Darfur, he says. Darfur is the next place to go. This is, it's the Israeli lobby, right-wing members of this administration, particularly the ones that you find most distasteful in this administration's coalition, that is the evangelical wing of it, these are the people who are pressing forward in Darfur. And, of course, a lot of self-promoters like Senator Obama and so forth.
Well, there's a lot of complexity here, and I think we'd be better served to sorting it out rather than just lampooning it as an as a pro-war rally, because I don't think that gets us very far.
Certainly seems what it is. Seems to be what it is.
A peace sending and peace, authentic peacekeeping forces is not the same as being pro-war. It may devolve that way, and I think it'd be more likely to devolve that way if we send in NATO troops or something like that. But I think that if the North, as it were, the West, as it's called, sometimes more properly, I guess, called the North, would take some responsibility for the legacy of colonialism in Africa, they would feel responsible to fund some disinterested peacekeeping groups. Canadians usually do pretty well, but I think I'd disadvocate them at this point, considering who's in charge in Canada now. But moving water and aid and building more less than temporary tent structures would be important in a peacekeeping circumstance. And I just, you know, I don't think we get very far by just by lampooning it. I think that the
sending
complexities.
Sending in NATO, you know, in a peacekeeping role, of course, is exactly what Clinton did in Kosovo.
And we attacked it at the time.
We attacked it at the time, as we should, and we shouldn't. There's a sense in which this administration is repeating all its old tricks. It's run out of new tricks, so it's repeating its old tricks. The run-up to the war on Iran looks like the run-up to war on Iraq, and the attempt to produce an enemy in Africa gives us a replay of the Clinton war against Serbia.
Well,
look where these places are. These are both places that are surround the U.S.'s major geopolitical concern, and that is Middle East energy resources. This goes back to the Somalia campaign.
Of course, the U.S. is a bad actor in this.
So we shouldn't be having rallies supporting
it. You can't deny that there is a conflict between blacks, whether they're Muslim or animists, and Arab cultural types all through the region.
I can deny that entirely. That's not what's going on.
I'm just saying on the broader scale, there's problems in Mauritania, there's problems in Senegal, all over the south of the Sahara, just on that interface, there is, and in many of those countries, an Arab elite that I've known some people that were exiled from Mauritania. I know that this is not this is a reality that you can't argue away by saying that you're on the side with these other folks who have bad motives. There are a lot of bad motives. We could talk about the AIPAC thing and how Nant Hentoff fits into it as well, and how Amy I think is being manipulated too, and how the news media is being manipulated. There's a complexity there that needs to be explained, and I hope we get to that.
That's not what's going on in Darfur.
You know exactly what's going on in Darfur, huh?
I know what's going on in Darfur is not the propaganda position of an Arab group attacking black Africans. That's not what's going on.
Well, I understand there's fighting amongst the rebels of the Fur peoples right now, that there's actually fighting almost all against all, kind of a really devolving into a total melee in midst of this ecological disaster that's happening on the south of the Sahara too, where the Sahara is spreading 2 kilometers further south every year or something like that, and that's pitting people against each other in this kind of tragic spiral.
All the people involved in the fighting in Darfur are black. All of them are Muslims. What the U.S. has done, what the propagandists who are promoting the pro-war rally in Washington tomorrow have done, what Senator Obama has done, has tried to separate them into the poor, oppressed blacks of Darfur and the Arab legions, the Arab militias who are oppressing them. That misrepresents the situation entirely. There is not that sort of racial divide that our identity politics wants to find.
Well,
there
doesn't exist. There is a cultural divide all through that area.
It's not a racial divide, though.
Well,
the primary divide is between agriculturalists and nomads, pastoralists, and the folks who have been recruited by the Khartoum government to counter a revolt. The fighting in Darfur began with a revolt by the agriculturalist groups, by the farmers of Western Darfur in 2003. It was quite conscious political revolt. Several political groups stood up against the Khartoum government. In response, the Khartoum government hired some of these nomadic groups to attack the farmers of Darfur. Now, there is fighting going on there, and there has been a serious attempt by the African Union to bring that fighting to an end. In fact, the Darfur agriculturalists, the farmers, the people that we are told that we have to be sympathetic to here in this fight, rejected a peace treaty this weekend. They rejected a peace treaty, probably on good grounds, because the treaty didn't give them enough of the things that they wanted, including a vice president in the Khartoum government. Now, these negotiations are going on. They're going on under the aspects of the African Union. But in the meantime, Senator Obama and others are cynically standing up there screaming for NATO troops in this region, just like we were told that if we didn't send NATO bombers to Kosovo, there would be a new Holocaust. That was all lies, as we know, in Clinton time, and I know you know, too. We're getting similar lies repeated. As I say, these folks don't show much imagination. A few degrees of latitude south, they've just shifted the Serbian problem to a North African problem now. The pro-war rally fits in very well with the sort of propaganda we've been getting, not just from the Bush administration. In fact, the Bush administration is worried about this. A lot of this support is coming from self-described liberals and Democrats, you know, who want to show that they're not soft on defense.
Well, they want to attack Iran, too, a lot of them.
Exactly.
Including Obama.
Quite right.
Including Obama.
Amen.
Well, I think we actually do have some consonance here, because I think we ought to actually, instead of sending NATO or advocating, we should send UN-authorized, amplify the current African presence to try. So there's only 7,000 in the state of Texas, as we hear. And we don't hear that...
One ranger, no riot. Huh?
We don't hear that the Darfurians rejected this agreement. We only hear on the national propaganda radio that the Khartoum government... rejected it. So
that's not what happened, actually.
Yeah, it's terribly... There's a lot of ignorance about it. There's a lot of people spinning it, and it's true. But there are some, I think, some irreducible facts in the situation that
I agree.
can't be delighted entirely.
But when we have pojures like Tom Lantos getting himself arrested in front of the Sudan embassy yesterday because he's so concerned about the oppressed people from Darfur, we know that the propaganda fix is in. And that's exactly what happened. You pointed out something people can read just opposite the editorial page in this morning's News Gazette, that while all this concern is being expressed and NATO troops are being called for, the UN agency responsible for feeding the people in that area, the World Food Program, says it's going to have to cut calorie allotments in half, down to 1,000 calories per person, because the United States and the other governments who are so concerned now about what's going on in Darfur have not come up with the money they need to pay for simply providing the food that the people in the area
pawns.
Need.
There are 2 million of them living in tents and in really despicable circumstances, and something does need to be done. But starting by cutting back on their caloric intake doesn't actually evince any real concern. That's true.
But the last thing that needs to be done is to send American troops or NATO bombers or American politicians, you know, to describe what should be done in Sudan, as they once described what should be done in Serbia. We've got another humanitarian war on our hands, and indeed, it's the same people in many cases, because this is being one of the ways this is being used. It's being used by the Clintonoid wing of the Democratic Party against the Bush administration. Why aren't you doing more about Darfur? Says cynics like Obama. At the same time, the Iran war is, as you say, an aspect of what's going on here. We had a vote in the House on an Iran liberation bill, just like, once again, they're repeating all their effects like tired magicians that don't have any new tricks, just like the run-up to the war in Iraq. And this bill was supported by these same pro-war Democrats throughout the House. There are only 21 votes against, out of the 435 members in the House, only 21 votes against the Iran Liberation Act this week, which some honest anti-war people like Dennis Kucinich called a stepping stone to war with Iran. 15 Democrats and 6 Republicans, including Ron Paul of Texas, voted against this, while the self-styled liberals in the House all voted for the Iran Liberation Act. I mean,
Lantos,
this is shameful.
Who we should call Lantos Hit and Run and Vote Lantos. I don't know if you know that story. Jeffrey Sinclair was talking about it at his visit, which we'll talk about at some point, I guess. Lantos was one of the major sponsors of this. It supposedly includes specific language to make it not represent a blank check for war with Iran. But,
right.
That'll be finessed rather easily, as the Bush administration, which can justify almost anything with anything, would be able to do. So we had a caller who asked me, how is Amy Goodman being manipulated about the Darfur question? Well, you might have more to say about that. I was trying to make an allusion to something that I think we should talk about. Nat Hentoff was featured on talking at a. I didn't investigate to find out who the sponsorship of this group was, but defending press freedom in the case of the AIPAC spy case. Now, I think this is being manipulated by the administration and Justice Department too. They could use other laws to charge these people than the Espionage Act from the World War One era. I think they want to use that to make it, you know, a valuable tool in suppressing suppressing press.
And that was Nat's point. That was Nat's point, right?
Yeah, but I think that what does he suggest, that, you know, the charges be dropped? I think that AIPAC should be called a agent of the foreign government, and they should be charged directly instead of being this weird thing. And what press did they release this information to? I also was looking around for that a little bit. Now, they're claiming that they told the Israeli embassy officials, but then they also talked to the press about these documents that were spirited out of, I guess, the State Department. What press did they release it to? Judy Miller? Judy Miller? It seems to me this is a bit of a caricature of press freedom, just as Judy Miller case was.
What we're talking about here is the Franklin case, where a deputy of Douglas Feith in the Defense Department passed along information to AIPAC members, that is the Israeli lobby people, and then directly to a representative of the Israeli embassy, who was quickly called home on leave when the story broke. But the charges are interesting, and I think Hentoff is onto something here, although I have no particular sympathy for AIPAC, and since what they were doing was trying to promote this war in Iran, it's certainly good that this sort of exposure has taken place. But it seems to me that Hentoff has a point when he says that what the U.S. is trying to do here, and this is part and parcel of the move towards the Patriot Act and the NSA spying and so forth, they're trying to set up an official secrets act using the 1917 Espionage Act, and trying to say that anyone who delivers information that is declared an official secret is guilty of that. And a similar issue is going on in fact, the similarity is quite close, with the CIA officer, Mary O'Brien.
We don't have to get her name exactly in any case, right. We know who we're talking about. Mary McCarthy.
Yeah, we do, but other people, Mary McCarthy, thank you. Mary McCarthy, not the author Mary McCarthy, but yeah. Mary McCarthy, who was just fired from the CAA, although she is a creature of the Washington bureaucracy, and a number of the usual bureaucrats have leapt forward and said, no, no, it wasn't she. But in any case, the issue here was that someone revealed to Dana Priest of the Washington Post that the U.S. had secret prisons in Europe and elsewhere. Well, you know,
the gulag,
it's worthwhile. Yeah. That's a gulag, and it should be talked about. But, of course, the administration already has won that one in the sense in that we're not talking about the gulag. We're not talking about the disappeared.
We're talking about her instead.
We're talking about whether or not this woman should be fired for revealing these secrets to a reporter.
Mm. Well, it's no longer
whether she
the Franklin
should be charged
case.
Further.
It's
she
no
was
longer the Franklin
she was
case.
Fired, but the
because
question is, should
guilty.
She be prosecuted? And if she is prosecuted, then, you know, what we're doing is setting up the sort of Official Secrets Act that Hentoff is speaking against, as he
I
should.
Agree with him on that point, but I think that he doesn't go as far as I would, which is say that Rosen and this other chap from AIPAC should be charged under other things. It's obviously it's being manipulated, and that's why I was making an allusion to Darfur. The situation needs address, but they're using it. And like I said, what press did they release it to? I think they just added this press connection just to, you know, to have this way of rallying people around. I don't know if I can call Hentoff a liberal. He's liberal on civil issues, civil libertarian issues, but he's obviously on the record being vociferously pro-Israel, you know, as, almost as much as AIPAC is in a lot of ways. So I think he's probably a willing tool. I think he's a knowing actor in this. And what he should call for, and what may have been called for by other people at this conference, though I have a feeling I doubt it, that these people need to be prosecuted on other charges, not to try to revive Espionage Act passed in the middle of World War I. And as you say, constructed, and as Hentoff says, constructed as. But on the other hand, you know, what press are we defending here? Who talked about these issues? I think that's a canard.
In the meantime, the Israeli lobby and the Democrats pressing for war against Iran did indeed succeed in the Iran Freedom Support Act. And I will say, Paul, the best column that I saw this week attacking this support for the war on Iran came from Patrick Buchanan. Buchanan had an absolutely clear description of what Congress was doing and why it should be doing the opposite and how they are promoting the government's war in Iran. The Bush administration is in a very interesting position on this. It's a please don't throw me into that briar patch position. The Bush administration opposed the Iran Freedom Support Act in the House of Representatives on the grounds that we have to give diplomacy time to work. And this while they're, of course, you know, and the other hand, they're rattling the saber about how we have to go against this psychopath who is president of Iran.
They're happy to be in the position of being seen as moderating the situation.
Exactly.
Where we have Condi Rice talking about it's now a challenge to the Security Council to how did she put it? Show their credibility.
The time for talking is over. Yes, that's
oh,
that's
I don't remember that quote.
Time for talking is over. She says time for the Security Council to take action.
Show its credibility is
the word. Show its credibility. Precisely right.
Who's got the credibility gap in this?
Well, we've heard of this credibility. Remember, the whole point of of attacking Kosovo in the Clinton administration was we had to do that in order to defend American credibility, NATO's credibility. But as several people pointed out, it wasn't Italy's credibility that NATO was defending. But yes, the credibility is a wonderful excuse.
Well, one wonders still about Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, a kind of secret base built by KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, who've been spun off by Halliburton. I asked Jeffrey Sinclair about why he thought that was happening. He said, well, it was a marginal part of their they only owned it for 40 years or something like that. Back to Iran. In Russia, the Israeli aircraft industries launched an Aeros B spy satellite to get a close look at what they were going to be blowing up soon, I guess is the implication. Interesting
with,
that the
but
Russians,
with Russian help,
Russians,
exactly.
Russians, they paid the Russians to do it. They didn't do it in Guyana or Suriname where the French launched, or they didn't ask, or maybe it was a favor from Putin to Bush, or Bush to Putin, I guess.
Well, I need some space, so to speak, in two senses of the word. They it's a little awkward to launch these things from Israel for fear of where they might come down, so to speak. So they need someone like the French or the Russians or so, plus with some empty space so they can launch these things in case of accident.
Yeah, it isn't a big satellite from the description I heard.
No. But it's still, you still need a pretty big rocket to get up in the air, as we found out. You know,
it'll be interesting to see how the demo that's going on today in New York City goes. They've included an anti-Iran attack provision in the... With some prodding, some arguments. You know, there's division in the ranks in the anti-war movement, too. When you mentioned Buchanan, I thought you were going to cite Justin Raimondo in anti-war, not another Antiwar-net, is it?
.com. Yeah, right.
Another conservative who's been incredibly
libertarian.
Critical. Yeah, he's his article is replete with all sorts of links that would take you probably a half a day to read fully.
It's an important article. I agree. I mean, the stuff and that website has had extremely good stuff. You know, from the beginning on this war, and shows something a point that, you know, I mentioned before, that the most principled criticism of this war in Iraq and indeed of American policy in the Middle East has often come from paleo conservatives, not the conservatives that get associated with the neocons, but from paleo conservatives. Such as those who crop up at antiwar.com, people like Raimondo and Buchanan.
Speaking of conservatives of an interesting flavor, I thought you probably would want to talk a little bit about Specter says he won't seek an immediate vote on this plan to terminate funding for the domestic surveillance program, but he wants to wake up the White House and stop the president from, quote, walking all over Congress. Mm-hmm. So apparently he hasn't been getting the kind of reassurances behind in the cloakroom and information that he wants, so he's his spine is stiffened. I think he probably be good to give him some emails, some attaboys, even though he we're not in his riding, his constituency.
At the same time, the majority leader of the House is saying that, yeah, they'll have a full-scale debate on the floor of the House on the war in Iraq. Now, I'll believe it when I see it, but I think I may have to believe it. I think they may do it. What it shows is, as Bush's polls continue, as the administration's polls continue to plummet, Congress has been noticing that their polls have been plummeting along with it, and the result has been a leaking away of support of the sorts that you just mentioned in the Senate and also in the House. So, you know, this is worthwhile.
Speaking of some debate on the Hill, there was another one of these informal conferences, and Pacifica covered it. Includes Paul Pelor, the CIA analyst, who has gone critical, hypercritical, I guess.
That's the way they look at it in the White
House. And a couple of Iraqi women, actually, speaking as well. And it's hosted by Vern Avery Brown, who we know from Pacifica's Pacific Radio News and prior to the whole kerfuffle there. And then also includes this guy, David Swanson, who is like the founder of After Downing Street Memo,
right,
which is still up on the web,
A very good website, as a matter of fact.
So I'll be interested to hear. I was taping it while listening to some other things. And a lot of it is, House progressives congratulating each other, so I think it actually deserves a little bit of editing. But
That's a good point. Or at least a little bit of commentary, which might be even more fun.
I can burn you a disc, I guess.
I'd appreciate it.
Another thing in the security business, we mentioned Spectre and the domestic surveillance. Breaking news this morning, they revealed it on a Friday after.
Yes. Yeah. Didn't they just?
It came out under the fold.
Right.
The FBI issued 9,254 national security letters in 2005, covering 3,500 U.S. citizens and legal foreign residents. Justice Department said the data did not include what probably were thousands of additional letters issued to obtain more limited information about some individuals, such as a home address or letters that were issued about targets who were in the U.S. illegally. So
and be clear what these are. These
Patriot
Security
Act,
letters. These are things. In a funny way, it was the Patriot Act. It was a concession, a sop thrown to critics of the Patriot Act that made it necessary for the Department of Justice actually to reveal this, as you say, in the news black hole this week that is late on Friday. Just be clear what's going on here. These so-called national security letters. They're tarted up with a name, national security. Oh, gee, must be important. Must be serious. National security letters. What these are simple demands by the FBI for information, demands that do not require any sort of court warrant. The FBI just comes in and says, hey, here's a national security letter. We need this information. Now, you know, you may have recalled something that's fallen into desuetude called the Fourth Amendment, which the founding fathers put in the Constitution to ensure that we would be free from unreasonable search and seizure. Well, these are certainly unreasonable search and seizures of information, and the amendment says they need a court warrant for that.
But Bill of Attainder by any other
name. The FBI says they don't. Mm. And the numbers are a bit staggering.
Watch for any news coverage of the rally in against the war in New York. I guess.
And watch for news coverage of the rally locally. For the war in Washington.
If anybody went, well, I think that's perverted.
Well, I will bet you. I agree with you that the rally is perverted, but I think that's not what you meant. I'm sure that the rally in Washington will be covered. Mm-hmm. The Darfur thing is on the front page of everybody's news. The retiring head of Amnesty International was interviewed on NPR this morning, and the first question from your friend Scott Simon to this guy was, well, what's the most important problem AI is dealing with? His answer, wait for it, Darfur.
Well, it is.
But it's not. That's nonsense,
Congo is as well. But
that's nonsense.
It's nonsense
on everything. Well, of course
Darfur
it is. Darfur
is a
propaganda
wound in the world's body politic.
It's a propaganda hype on the part of democratic liberals in this country.
There is a propaganda hype around it, but that does not. There is a irreducible tragedy in the sub-Saharan part of Africa, the legacy of the colonials' drawing of the map of Sudan, amongst other things.
Darfur is not sub-Saharan. And in matter of fact, you may ask. It's in the western Sudan on the Chadian border. And in terms of the propaganda malarkey that we're getting about Darfur, it has been entirely and completely misrepresented from the beginning in the press. So that if you ask the average well-informed person what's going on in Darfur, he will tell you Arabs are suppressing black people. And this is a terrible tragedy, and something must be done. We've got to send troops.
Well, this builds on you mentioned the evangelicals are involved. They were involved in the southern part of Sudan because of the Christian animus divide and the Islamic center. Khartoum is definitely ruled by an Arab minority. It's true. I mean, it's irreducible. That doesn't mean
Khartoum is ruled by an Arab minority. What do you mean by that?
Khartoum, the capital of and the country of Sudan is ruled by an Arab minority.
Well, not even clear whether it's in fact not ruled by an Arab minority in any reasonable sense of the word Arab. The people in Sudan are to any American eye black.
Well,
and
ask them who they are.
Arabic is spoken in parts of Sudan. The population is Muslim. The dominant population in Sudan is Muslim. The civil war you're talking about, which is separate from the Darfur business, that has recently been brought to an end, or at least a truce, is between the Muslim blacks of North Sudan and the Christian and animist, as you say, blacks of South Sudan. But this is removed from the Darfur business.
I was talking about the way the evangelicals have been involved for a decade, because they were involved from the early days in the activity around the South Sudan.
And it's these evangelicals, along with the Israeli lobby, who are the primary moving forces behind the pro-war rally about Darfur in Washington that's going on tomorrow.
I think we'll have to leave that
I'm
late.
I'm surprised to see you making common cause with them.
I am not. I'm saying we have to make a better discourse and explain it better than they are, and then actually get beyond the ignorance of the manipulation. And
well, the first thing we have to do,
and I don't think calling it a pro-war rally is a good place
exactly
to start.
That's exactly what it is.
I'm
well,
hoping that
watch
somebody,
for it. It'll be on the
somebody
news.
Gets up there and cuts through it. Somebody like the guy from, gosh, I can't remember his name now. He's not with Trans Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We'll cut through it a little bit. It might be a teaching moment.
But, Paul, it's important to see that what's going on here has been a colossal misrepresentation of the situation, a misrepresentation that's not innocent, but that depends upon trying to find another official enemy like Serbia.
Just,
you know, this one, as I say, a few miles south.
Just like using the Espionage Act to muddy the waters and usher in an official secrets
That's
act.
A rather distant parallel.
Well, but, I'm saying it's manipulation, and there's a whole lot of manipulation on all scores. Speaking
but the important thing is to see what actually is going on.
Well, I don't think you're a good consul. I think people need
Sudan,
to do some research, including looking at your geography.
the first thing to do is to see what's actually going on in Sudan, and the second thing to do is to see the how it's being used for propaganda in this country by democratic liberals like Senator Obama. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Scott Simon, I have a couple of interventions on him. If you got up early, the first interview he did was with, wait for it, Zalmay Khalilzad. And his, one of his impertinent questions, you know, he was just probing, when you're talking to the Iraqi people you're trying to work with, do they regard you as an American or a Sunni? And Khalilzad said, I'm paraphrasing, well, they refer to me in a lot of ways. They look at me in a lot of different ways. And I immediately thought, well, do they think of you as an oil consultant for Unocal, perhaps? Mm-hmm. Do they think of you in that way, too?
As an imperialist, as a comprador, an imperialist satrap. Yeah, these would work. These are
that
all good.
Have been a little bit too penetrating for another thing in the conversation that Shore and Scott Simon on Weekend Edition do. There was no mention of this being the deadliest month on record in Iraq for Americans, mm-hmm. and even more so for Iraqis.
Deadliest in the last 6 months or so, yes, right.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think what they do is after the initial success that was announced. Well, I think we're approaching a 2-year anniversary.
Exactly. On the 1st of May. Yes.
Of the Top Gunning, Top Gun landing on the, and the manipulation of the sunset and all that sort of stuff. There was no mention of the Rove grilling either the fifth visit to the grand jury. Rove isn't having such a grand day. And before we get too further, this is not about NPR, but this is about a press issue. I'll be the first to coin the expression, he's snowing the press again.
Mm. This is I don't think you made it as the first.
Oh, really? Somebody's already talked about Tony Snow being a snower. Mm-hmm. I think he'll actually will do that. He'll sort of deluge people with stuff rather than just being obstinate and repetitive. He'll more carefully finesse and change the subject when people keep asking him the same question. So he's been...
Well, he may have some stuff to do about that. I mean, there are folks who are talking, and it may be Fitzmas again, you know, Fitzmas in the spring. Fitzmas was the term that was coined when Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, went after people on the Plame case in this administration. And now after Rove's, fifth appearance before the grand jury? Three hours the other day about it. The suggestion is that those who are looking for an indictment of the administration on this matter may get their wish. Their Fitzmas present may arrive. Patrick Fitzgerald may indeed do that. One can hope, but it'll be maybe Tony Snow's first job will be to explain that away.
Any other judicial proceedings you'd like to comment on? I have Colonel Stephen Jordan, the former head of Interrogation Center, being charged with 12 counts, including misrepresenting facts. That's a fallback that they use for a lot of people. HumanRightsFirst.org has just released a preliminary report on detainee abuse and accountability called By the Numbers. I bet you if you just searched for By the Numbers, but you can just go to HumanRightsFirst.org. It's a coalition of a couple of different groups that are correlating. And there's a quote here that I wanted to get in. Two officers senior to Jordan, he's a lieutenant colonel, and he's a reservist, which I think in the Army that means a lot. You know, he's not of the regular Army, as was Karpinski, right? Well, only two officers senior to Jordan and Abu Ghraib have been disciplined by the Army, but neither of them faced criminal charges. Now, who are they counting there? Are they counting Karpinski?
I wonder
who else are they counting?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Jeffrey Miller can't get his extra star because they can't allow him to go before a congressional hearing to be authorized to it. And he's actually being ordered, apparently, not to take the equivalent of the Fifth Amendment in another case that's going forward. So maybe some of this is gonna keep having legs. We thought they were gonna finesse some of this stuff with the Rove inquiry going on, and then invoking Jeffrey Sinclair, he mentioned the Safafian case as opening up on the 22nd of May, and that might have some interesting implications if they flip him. I'm worried again about that one being continued past the election, because
this is the
Safafian guy is the guy that chief executive on procurement, which procuring money for different groups that are getting lobbied here.
We may have to distinguish that now.
$300 billion worth of contracts, I was told this week, by a right-wing guy who was writing about the decay in the Republican Party and the greediness. There's even it was pretty clear he was trying to make his money on the book because he was saying the title of the book over and over. But it was an interesting little vignette.
I've got a procurement. I want to pick up the procurement line. I'm having trouble with that, aren't I? Procurement line here. At the top of my notes today, Paul, there were two words. The first was NATO, and that's obviously refers to the Darfur business. And the second one was FOGO. FOGO is back. The delightfully named Dusty FOGO has reemerged. I mean, it was interesting enough. This is Porter Goss's deputy at the CIA, and he's reemerged in what could be the most amusing scandal to come out of Washington for a while, but is also bound up with the things that our friend Jeffrey Sinclair was talking about in his new book, Grand Theft Pentagon, which is a must-read, I think, in terms of how this government works. But in any case, Dusty FOGO is back because he may be caught up in the new Hookergate. That it has turned out that one of the things the defense contractors who were buying Randy Duke Cunningham, one of the things they were paying him with was prostitutes.
Knights on the town, huh?
They were setting, and where were they setting up? Oh, it's too cute. It's too lovely. In the Watergate. They were setting up hospital. The Watergate is a big hotel in Washington, mm-hmm. which for those of you who came in late was involved in the departure of Richard Nixon. But in any case, what these defense contractors were doing was providing immense amounts of money to to congressmen like Dusty and sorry, I'm getting the monikers wrong here, like Duke Cunningham. Now, he's out. He resigned and so forth. He's under indictment. He's admitted to a good
Randy's
bit of what
gone.
He's done.
I think he's incarcerated.
I think
now.
He's in jail. Mm-hmm. He admitted to a good bit of what he was doing, including putting out a menu of what contractors could buy for how much money. For this much bribe, they could get this sort of earmark.
Did he have call girls on the list?
But what didn't come up in his mea culpa about this and in his trial was the fact that a lot of people were involved in this, particularly were involved in the provision of hookers and whatnot for congressmen. At least a half a dozen congressmen now are mentioned, and one highly placed intelligence official. The suggestion is it's Porter Goss, the head of the CIA. Now, one of the reasons this connection may be interesting, and this finally brings me back to Dusty FOGO, is that when Goss became head of the CIA, he reached way down in the ranks of the CIA, jumping over all sorts of people, and took this guy, Kyle Dusty FOGO, and made him number three in the agency. Well, it turns out that Dusty FOGO's best friend from the time he was in junior high school is a man named Wilkes, who was who was a defense contractor and one of the primary bribers of Cunningham. FOGO and Wilkes are tied up, for a long time. And the suggestion is that the hospitality suites, the money, the presents, and the hookers were all provided to these Congress people and to CIA folks. Remember, Goss was a member of Congress before he became head of the CIA, and that he may indeed be the high intelligence official mentioned.
Is there a
this.
Court case where discovery is going ahead on this, so some of this can be revealed? Or how is this coming out now?
There are actually, since it finally has surfaced, I mean, this has been kicking around for a long time. A lot of people knew it since before the Cunningham
Capitol
revelations.
Capitol Hill Blue, or where does one go for this kind of seamier side.
Well, it's
stuff.
Kicking around the blogosphere right now and is worth, I mean, you know, Google Dusty FOGO. I love that. I mean, the name is
where
so
they
good.
Get the
it's
names?
Gonna be placed.
Remember the
right.
guy last weekend on 60 Minutes, Tyler Drumheller?
Yes, yeah, Drumheller. that's also CIA question and an important one because he's another guy like Paul Pillar, who you mentioned earlier, who is talking about, look, we told the administration what the story was in Iraq before the war, and they lied about it because they wanted their war in Iraq.
Well, I was amazed about the 60 Minutes thing was that how much FaceTime the ambassador went to Niger got on it.
What, Joe Wilson?
Yeah, Joe Wilson had a lot of explanatory interludes on the thing, and I was happy to see the coverage. Fairly cutting.
Once again, I mean,
after it's all done, you can
talk.
Yeah.
Exactly. These are things of arriving very late to the party. The U.S. media should not be given be cut any slack on this. I mean, all of these stories, all of this information, including the salacious business about the Watergate, all of that was in possession of the media, and they chose not to not to reveal it. One of the reasons we see such attacks on bloggers as not being real journalists is that the real journalists, whose job is to control this information, you realize that the blogs make it harder for them to control it. And when the stuff does emerge, they're going to have to say something about it. This happens elsewhere, too. It was revealed this last week that the European Union investigation has led to the information that were at least 1,000 clandestine CIA flights passing yep. through Europe. While we're concentrating on whether or not a reporter can receive information from a CIA agent, what that information is really about, that is the secret prisons that the U.S. keeps around the world and the people it's disappeared into them, this stuff is surfacing slowly in Europe. So finally, late in the day, after the fact, when it doesn't make much difference anymore, we begin to hear certain stories from the American medium.
We've gotten 45 minutes into the show and we haven't mentioned something that's supposed to be on the tip of everybody's tongues. I suppose you rode your 18 speed over here today, didn't you? Eschewing the gasoline economy?
I didn't either.
So.
No, I did. I do know, though, that the gasoline prices have peaked for a little while. We've hit a peak and a plateau. I had to fill my tank yesterday, and whenever I have to fill my tank, it always happens at the time the gasoline prices peak.
We're gonna
level off at least for a while now.
Yeah, some amazing stuff went down on this. I heard them comparing their 9% profit to Apple's 25% profit or some other computer industries, etc. And what I immediately thought, since I came out of the grocery business a little bit through my grandparents' store, that grocery stores, places that sell necessities, they cut 2 and 3%, and if they're lucky, profit at the volume that they sell, because it's a necessity and you have to, you don't have to buy everything you buy, but you have to buy something to eat. And so comparing the petroleum industry to the profits of high-tech firms, I think is purposefully misleading, and a windfall profit tax would be the least thing to do. One thing other that bothers me in the discourse is that they say we have to have high profits so we can do reinvestment and build refineries and stuff. Hey, how can they get away with saying that? Profits are profits. They've been dispersed through dividends. They've been dispersed to the people that are getting these huge money amounts. They, that isn't the money that's going into research and development for other activities, green or otherwise. It isn't going into building refineries. That's loot that's been skimmed off the top.
But we know this argument works because, the drug companies use it all the time.
Yeah, when they spend more money on advertising those idiotic ads and all their perks for doctors than they do on research and development. If they actually ever had an accounting to see how much intellectual property they subverted from the government-financed labs, et cetera, they would, they'd have to fork over a lot of money to reimburse us for that. Anyway,
interesting studies.
I'm going to get apoplectic here.
Interesting studies show too that if you simply made public all the research and development that's done on drugs, in other words, do it with public money under public control, it would actually cost less than the drug companies claim they're spending on research and development right now. And of course, you would do it better.
And we'd have a side benefit, which was there wouldn't be as much privacy involved in proprietarial rights.
And another side benefit in terms of the
polluting the academia right now.
That's quite right. That's very true. And you also could choose where you wanted to put your research on. Is the research should be devoted to making better and better Viagra because there's a market for that? Or should research be devoted actually to dealing with diseases that could be could be helping by a serious R&D effort. These are arguments that don't get carried on, and they should.
Any comments on Kenny Boy in the doc? Apparently he was supposed to be finishing up Thursday, and he's been brought back for repeat engagement. And the most peculiar thing, he was railing against the Wall Street Journal. And it turns out this guy, Jason Leopold, again, who Jeffrey Sinclair mentioned, who's got a new book out called News Junkie, and apparently was a Dow Jones correspondent who did a lot of the early Enron stuff in California, went to Houston to find out what was going on. And he's actually had his name on some of the Wall Street Journal's articles that Lay was decrying as undermining the credibility of his company. The other thing he called was the short sellers. What was the third one? turning out that one of his sons was a major short seller four different times.
And they caught him on that. The prosecutor snuck up on him with that one.
Yeah, his son didn't come clean on it. Apparently, one of the complications for Kenny Boy, if you want to lament with him, is that his major defense attorney has a health problem that's kept him out, and he's working with a guy that he apparently doesn't like much, and he's actually having contretemps with his own attorney as well as with the prosecuting attorney.
Sounds like Massawe, doesn't it?
Yeah. There is a comparison that can be made. Again, the thing that bothers me is that he's being tried for, you know, lying about Enron and its condition, et cetera, and he's not being tried for crimes like which predate the Bush administration, favors given to Enron in India by the Clinton administration, and then I was citing this. There are many other deals that Enron has gotten special juice on.
We had the revelation of another conspiracy this week too. That's worth commenting on. Public Citizen and United for a Fair Economy has published a report about 18 wealthy families in the U.S. who have consciously put together over several years now a campaign against the estate taxes. That's the reason our congressional representative always refers to death taxes. You know, cynically done by the richest people in the country to protect their wealth. I mean, to protect it against the faintly equalizing move that inheritance taxes put in place. In a sense, people knew this was going on, in spite of some high-profile folks like Bill Gates' father stepping forward and saying there should be inheritance taxes.
I think that's what they were rising to the occasion going after the group for responsible taxation.
What Public Citizen and United for Fair Economy have done here is explain how the conspiracy was put together. I mean, as you point out, Paul, there are obvious conspiracies frequently in American history, but the only one that has ever come to court specifically as a conspiracy like that was the attempt to destroy urban mass transit systems as they existed in the early part of the 20th century in order to make way for automobiles and buses. Disposition of that case, and I think about 1949, National City Transit was fined for this vast conspiracy that changed transportation in the U.S. They were fined $5,000. I think.
Ah, you're letting me go to one of the real nuggets of this 18 families is the Public Citizen announced that these 18 families would be able to keep $80 billion of their well-earned money if they extend the so-called death tax.
Maybe we should fine them $5,000 for doing this.
Yeah, I think that would be an order.
Families has a nice mafia sound, too, that sets up the parallel, which is quite great.
It's like the 18 families in El Salvador that still go back to the conquistador days.
Similar conspiracies, yes.
As bloody, too, in its own way. We were talking about. I was talking and mentioning when we were talking about the immigrant issue, talking about how high-paying abattoir jobs, slaughterhouse jobs in the meat industry have been taken over by a lot of illegal workers without union benefits and with very low pay for the job that they do, which is very dirty and very gross. I guess you can get beyond that. But anyway, a lot of these companies have actually sort of acknowledged that they run on undocumented workers because they're actually closing as a matter of course. I guess it's a kind of peculiar way to get a large corporation to honor May Day, but that's apparently how one interpretation could be made.
Well, and of course, the other big thing will be happening on May Day is rallies across the country on the immigrant issue. There's a great deal of dismay in the government and the usual attempts to try to undercut this and say, well, it might be divisive. I mean, if the rallies really are big, why, then maybe the government won't want to be nice to illegal immigrants as they're planning to be. I mean, this is nonsense, of course, but they've got the usual people scared. The mayor of Los Angeles, who is the son of a Mexican immigrant, has suddenly decided, after saying that he would be on the platform for the rally in Los Angeles, has suddenly decided he's got to go to Texas to talk to the National Football League about getting an NFL team for Los Angeles.
Villa Ragosa has backed out.
Exactly. And as we were talking about last week, the politics in this are fairly deep and complex, and they also need to be cleared fired up because, of course, one of the things that's going on here is the interests of major employers to have what the old man in the British Museum called a reserve army of the unemployed. And it's even better if they're illegal and in fear of being sent out of the country. So.
There's an interesting twist in California, particularly other places as well, about the school walkouts. Now, there's actually a documentary film that is called Walkout, brought to us, to my attention, by Democracy Now, as she does so well so often. But one of the aspects is that they're saying, well, if we can't count you in our population quota, we will lose money from the state. Yeah. So it kind of makes it sound like an incarceration situation, wouldn't you say?
It's like, sure. Like, that's the parallels with prisons, you know, have been made before. Another scandal, a lot of scandals this week. Mm-hmm. A lot of the scandal involved Illinois congressperson Bobby Rush, who pocketed a large amount of money to vote against net neutrality in the...
Sponsor the bill.
Exactly. And at the same time, I mean, you know, important things are going on here. This is the sort of thing that our colleague Dr. No usually covers in... digital citizen. We may actually get to some of that week. But the Electronic Freedom Foundation sued AT&T over its supine response to the NSA, to the National Security Agency, when they came looking for electronic information. And quietly at the end of this week, the Department of Justice has intervened in the suit, saying the court shouldn't consider the suit at all because, of course, there are, wait for it, national security implications.
I think they're going to keep changing their name. They were SBC, they were Ameritech before that, and now they're AT&T.
It's not even clear to me whether the AFS suit is against the old AT&T or the new one, but now they are rolled up together so that SBC bought the old AT&T and took on the name. So,
here's one item I wanted to get in. I should have got it in on when we were talking about the oil price and the gasoline price, but Anthony Juhasz was on... this week with Democracy Now! She has a book out called The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time. She has a chapter called A Mutual Seduction. And this has to do with something we've argued about periodically, the perfidy of the petroleum industry and whether they were really opposing a war in Iraq or not. They have a quote from Ken Dare, the former CEO of Chevron in 1998. The quote being, Iraq possesses huge reserves of oil and gas, reserves I would love Chevron to have access to. Mm-hmm. And followed up by a quote from John Gibson, chief executive of Halliburton Energy Services Group, related to somebody we know in high places, who says, we hope Iraq will be the first domino and that Libya and Iran will follow. We don't like being kept out of markets because it gives our competitive and unfair advantage. So we have the Pentagon to give us to even the playing
field. As if markets had anything to do with it. Yeah. I mean, market in a sense of a real market, you know, a controlled market in the way that the American, what we call capitalism, although it's pretty far, once again, from what the old guy in the British Museum would have called
capitalism. People are making the comparison to Europe and how much more they pay over there. But actually, if you take off the taxes, which the European governments are using to keep traffic down and use for things like... mass transit. If you just look at, you take the taxes out, we're actually paying more to the oil companies and the related industries than the Europeans are. So this idea that, you know, taxes, changing the taxes is going to make a difference is a bunch of hooey.
I thought one of the most disturbing things that happened this week, Paul, was two reports, actually several from the Defense Department and one from the State Department that rather casually and quietly got put out at the beginning of the week. And the description in the Defense Department report was for increased special operations around the world, dirty wars around the world, and the casual assertion that these wars should be carried on by the Defense Department working out of embassies without the permission of the American ambassador in these countries, that occasionally the American ambassador would be told what the Defense Department was doing. This is nothing less than a coup, Paul.
Yep.
A coup of international
proceeding apace.
War around the world by the Defense Department. At the same time, the Department of State released a report on terrorism that used the long war language again. Terrorism, of course, means anybody the U.S. is after, and so terrorism is up because the United States is after a lot of folks, but this is going to require, says the Department of State, a long war.